Usually when we talk about buying a stock, there's this this expectation of precision.
Right.
Like it feels almost like engineering, you know? You look at a ticker on your screen, you see the price down to the literal penny, you click buy, and boom, you own a fractional piece of a company.
Yeah, it's very clean.
Exactly. It's this transparent binary transaction. You bought the shares at that exact second for that exact price.
Total immediate gratification.
Yeah.
You have complete clarity on what just happened in your portfolio.
But then you step into the world of packaged products,
Oh, man.
right? Mutual funds, investment companies, and suddenly that clean, transparent transaction is just, it's completely gone.
It vanishes.
You're operating in a financial landscape that is, honestly, it's incredibly murky.
Yeah.
We're talking about hidden fees, delayed pricing that you can't even see when you click the buy button, bizarre tax rules.
Backdoor distribution agreements.
Yes. And if you don't know the mechanics of this ecosystem, you are basically flying blind. And if you're studying for the Series 7 exam right now, flying blind means you are going to get absolutely crushed by the test writers.
Which is exactly why you have to understand the architecture underneath these products. I mean, the exam isn't just testing if you know what a mutual fund is.
Right.
It's testing if you know where the landmines are buried, when someone actually tries to buy or sell one in the real world.
And digging up those landmines is our entire mission for this deep dive today. But before we start pulling the pins, a quick note. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Yeah.
If you're prepping for your Series 7, they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge.
It's an incredible resource to keep your brain locked in. So check it out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's really built for how people actually retain information.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's unpack this ecosystem. We are conquering the packaged products and investment companies section of the Series 7 today.
What's it doing?
And we're doing it with zero dry lectures. We're going to explore the bizarre mechanics of how funds actually work. We'll flag the exact traps the exam sets for you. And we're going to use some very specific characters today to help us visualize the chaos.
I love that because the chaos really begins with the rule book itself. I mean, you cannot talk about mutual funds without talking about the Investment Company Act of 1940.
1940. So we're looking at regulations born right out of the Great Depression.
Right, which is the crucial context here.
Yeah.
Because after the crash of 29, the government realized they couldn't just let Wall Street pool retail money together in the dark anymore.
Because it was the Wild West back then.
It totally was. Funds were excessively leveraged, they were incredibly opaque, and when the market cracked, I mean, retail investors just lost everything.
Wow.
So the 1940 Act steps in and essentially forces every investment pool into one of three very strict, very specific legal buckets.
Okay, let's walk through those three buckets. Bucket number one.
Face amount certificate companies.
I feel like I only ever read about these in historical textbooks.
Because they're basically dinosaurs at this point.
Right.
They issue debt certificates at a discount, and investors pay into them in installments, and then eventually the company pays back a fixed, face amount at maturity.
So it's a fixed return.
Yeah. But they're virtually extinct today because inflation generally just destroys their value.
Yeah.
And honestly, modern bonds are just much more efficient.
Okay.
So for the exam, just recognize the name, know it's one of the three types, and then move on. Do not agonize over the mechanics of a T-Rex.
Fair enough, the T-Rex goes in the museum. What is the second legal structure?
That would be the Unit Investment Trust or UIT.
Okay, I love the UIT because whenever I try to picture a UIT, I think of a crockpot meal.
The crock pot.
Yeah, or like a culinary time capsule.
Okay, walk me through that.
So think about how you make a stew in a crockpot. You chop up your ingredients, the carrots, the potatoes, the beef. In finance terms, those are your specific bonds or stocks. So you toss them all into the pot, you put the heavy lid on, you set the timer for, say, 8 hours, and you walk away.
Okay, I see where you're going.
You do not lift the lid, you do not stir the soup, you do not add more salt halfway through. You literally don't touch it until the timer goes off.
That is genuinely a perfect analogy because the defining characteristic of a unit investment trust is what it intentionally lacks.
Yep, exactly.
A UIT has no board of directors, it has no investment advisor, there is absolutely zero active management.
Right, there's no chef standing over the stove tweaking the recipe every hour.
None. The portfolio is selected at creation and it is locked. It remains virtually unchanged until the trust hits its preset termination date.
The timer.
Exactly. When that date arrives, when the crockpot timer dings, the portfolio is liquidated
Yeah.
and the proceeds are just distributed to the investors.
And because there's no hotshot portfolio manager, you know, picking stocks every single day, I assume the fees are rock bottom.
Oh, yes, significantly lower than actively managed funds. There's no management fee dragging down your return. Now, listener, I want you to lock this specific phrasing into your brain for the exam.
Okay, pay attention here.
UITs do not issue shares. They issue redeemable units.
Units?
Yes, units representing an undivided interest in that fixed portfolio.
Units, not shares. Got it. So if I want someone to actually actively manage my money, like if I want the chef in the kitchen stirring the soup and adapting to the market, the UIT is completely useless to me.
Totally useless.
I need to move to the third bucket.
You need the management company. This is the heavyweight champion of the 1940 Act. This is where you actually have a board of directors and an investment advisor making active, ongoing buy and sell decisions.
Okay.
But before a management company can even open its doors and take a single dollar from the public, the SEC forces them to declare exactly how they're going to manage their diversification.
Diversification, the ultimate Wall Street buzzword. Let's bring in our first recurring character to help us visualize this. Let's call her Frantic Fiona.
Frantic Fiona, okay.
Yeah, Fiona is this high-energy Wall Street hotshot, always chasing the next big trend, and she wants to launch her own mutual fund. And she decides to name it the Fiona Fully Diversified Fund because, you know, it sounds great for marketing.
Naturally.
But she can't just slap the word diversified on her prospectus because she feels like it, can she?
Absolutely not. The SEC does not care about her marketing strategy. If Fiona wants to legally put the word diversified anywhere near her fund, she has to pass what is known as the 75-5-10 test.
Okay, listener, I want you to pause and picture those three numbers hovering in the air right now. 5-10. Walk us through the math on this, and more importantly, why the math even exists.
Okay, first the 75. At least 75% of the fund's total assets must be invested in securities of other issuers, government securities, or cash.
Meaning 75% of the total pie must be spread out into the market. You can't just hoard it all in one place.
Exactly. Spread the risk.
Makes sense. So what about the 5 and the 10?
Okay. These apply strictly within that 75% portion. Rule 1. No more than 5% of the fund's total assets can be invested in the securities of any single issuer.
Right.
Rule 2, the fund cannot own more than 10% of the outstanding voting stock of any single issuer.
Let me push back on this a bit because it feels like kind of arbitrary math. Why? Okay. 5 and 10, like why does the SEC care if Fiona just really loves a particular stock?
It comes back to history again. The 5% rule protects the fund's investors from a complete catastrophe.
How so?
Well, if Fiona puts 40% of her fund into one tech company, and that company turns out to be the next Enron and goes completely bankrupt, her entire fund is wiped out.
Oh, right.
So capping a single position at 5% ensures that one corporate collapse doesn't destroy the life savings of Fiona's investors.
Okay, so the 5% protects the investors. What about the 10% rule? Why can't she own more than 10% of a company's voting stock?
That protects the broader economy.
Wait, really?
Yeah, think about it. If mutual funds could just buy up unlimited voting shares, they could become shadow monopolies. A giant fund could buy 51% of the voting stock in Delta, United, and American Airlines.
Oh, wow.
Right. Suddenly, a mutual fund manager is effectively controlling the entire airline industry and fixing ticket prices. So the 10% limit keeps mutual funds as passive investors and prevents them from becoming corporate raiders or, you know, shadow monopolies.
That makes so much sense. It's not just arbitrary math. It's literally antitrust protection.
Exactly.
Okay, so 75% of the fund is the diversified zone. Max 5% in one company, max 10% of that company's voting stock.
But here is the flashing red light for the exam. This is the trap almost everyone falls into.
Oh, lay it on me.
The exam will give you a scenario about a fund, and they will ask you about the other 25% of the portfolio.
The leftover part.
Yes. The 5% and 10% rules only apply to the 75% diversified portion.
Wait, I want to make sure I'm hearing this right. What can Frantic Fiona do with the remaining 25% of her fund's cash?
Literally whatever she wants.
Seriously?
She can take that entire remaining 25% chunk and dump every single penny of it into one highly speculative biotech stock if she feels like it.
Yeah.
It has zero restrictions.
That is wild to me. So Fiona could have a full 25% of her massive fund concentrated in one single company. And as long as the other 75% follows the strict 5 and 10 rules, the SEC looks at it and says, yep, That is a legally diversified fund.
That is exactly what they say.
Yeah.
And the exam writers know that feels counterintuitive to a normal person,
right,
which is why they test it constantly.
Okay.
The limits apply to the 75% portion. The remaining 25 is a total free-for-all.
Okay, so Fiona passes the 75-5-10 test. She has her management company. But within the management company bucket, she has to make one more massive structural choice, right? The great divide. She has to be either an open-end fund or a closed-end fund.
Yeah, this is the architectural foundation you really have to understand. Everything else we talk about today, how the funds are priced, how they trade, how they use leverage, it all flows entirely from whether Fiona chooses open-end or closed-end.
Okay, let's put them in a boxing ring. Open-end first. This is your classic standard mutual fund that sits in basically everyone's 401k, right?
Right. The defining feature of an open-end fund is continuous issuance.
Yeah.
Meaning, if a new investor comes along and wants to put $10,000 into Fiona's fund, the fund literally creates brand new shares out of thin air, takes the cash, and issues those shares to the investor.
Okay.
And when that investor wants to leave, they sell their shares back directly to the fund. The fund pays them out, and those shares are destroyed. It's this continuous loop of creation and destruction.
So the total number of shares in existence is constantly fluctuating every single day.
Every single day. Yeah. And because the fund itself is the counterparty, you know, you're buying from the fund and selling to the fund, the shares are always, always priced based on the net asset value, the NAV.
Right. And we'll dive into the math of NAV shortly.
Definitely. Also, crucially, the 1940 Act severely restricts open-end funds from using leverage. They generally cannot issue senior securities like bonds to borrow money.
But why not? If Fiona's a good manager, shouldn't she be allowed to borrow money to juice her returns?
Again, go back to 1929. The crash was exacerbated by massive unregulated margin borrowing.
Right. Everyone was over-leveraged.
Exactly. So the SEC decided that if a fund is going to promise daily liquidity to mom-and-pop investors, meaning you can ask for your cash back literally any day you want, that fund cannot be burdened with massive debts.
Because there's a run on the bank?
Yeah. If the market tanks and investors rush the exits, a heavily indebted open-end fund would just collapse instantly.
Okay, so open-end is continuous shares priced at NAV and no borrowed money. Contrast that with the closed-end fund.
The closed-end fund is built entirely differently. It does not continuously issue shares. Instead, it issues a fixed number of shares exactly once through an initial public offering, an IPO.
Just like a regular tech company going public, they ring the bell, sell the shares, and that's it.
Precisely. Once that IPO is done, the fund closes its doors to new capital. The share count is permanently fixed.
Okay, listener, I have a direct question for you. Think about this scenario. If frantic Fiona launches a closed-end fund, and a week after the IPO, you decide you want to buy some shares, do you call up Fiona's fund and buy them from her?
Hmm.
Take a beat and think. No, you can't. The fund's doors are closed. So where do you go to buy them?
You have to go to the secondary market. You go to an exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange, and you have to find another investor who bought during the IPO and is willing to sell their shares to you.
Which completely severs the relationship between the share price and the actual value of the assets, doesn't it?
It does. Because it trades on an exchange, a closed-end fund's price is determined purely by supply and demand, not by the NAV.
Wow.
So the underlying stocks in the fund might technically be worth $20 a share, but if nobody wants to buy the fund today, the price on the exchange might drop to $18.
And that leads to a huge exam trap. Because I would assume that since a closed-end fund has a limited fixed supply of shares, it would naturally trade at a premium, like, you know, limited edition sneakers. People would overpay for access.
It is a totally logical assumption, and it is almost entirely wrong in the real world.
Really?
Yeah. Historically and practically, the vast majority of closed-end funds trade at a discount to their NAV on the open market.
But why? I mean, if I can mathematically see that the fund owns $20 worth of Apple and Microsoft per share, why on earth would the market only offer $18 for it? Why the discount?
Because the market price is in friction. Investors look at the fund and they see a management fee that will drag on returns forever. They see liquidity constraints. You know, it might be hard to sell large blocks of shares without moving the price.
Right.
They see the risk that the manager might make bad trades. So the market demands a discount to take on those frictions. If you see an exam question asking about the relationship between a closed-end fund's price and its NAV, the default assumption should always be that it trades at a discount.
Okay, that's a great tip. What about leverage? The open-end funds couldn't borrow money because of the run on the bank risk. Can closed-end funds borrow?
Yes, because they don't have to worry about redemptions.
Ah, because the fund isn't paying out the cash.
Exactly. Because investors just trade shares with each other on the exchange, a closed-end fund never has to liquidate its portfolio to pay out a panicking investor. Therefore, the SEC allows them to use leverage subject to strict asset coverage rules.
Break down those coverage rules for us.
So for debt, meaning issuing bonds or borrowing from a bank, they must maintain 300% asset coverage.
Okay.
For issuing preferred stock, they need 200% asset coverage.
Let's translate that out of jargon. Let's do the 300% debt rule. What does that actually look like on a balance sheet?
It means for every $1 the fund borrows, it must have $3 in total assets. It acts as this massive shock absorber.
Okay, so if they borrow a million.
If the fund borrows $1 million, it needs $3 million in total assets. That way, even if the stock market crashes and the portfolio loses 50% of its value, the fund still has $1.5 million in assets.
Ooh, I see, yeah.
Yeah, it can still easily pay back the $1 million loan.
Yeah.
It prevents catastrophic insolvency.
That is brilliant. Okay, so we've established the great divide, open-end versus closed-end. Let's dive deeper into open-end mutual funds because this is where the pricing mechanism gets incredibly weird.
Forward pricing.
Yes. I want to use an absurd scenario here. Listener, imagine you go to a very high-end, extremely weird seafood restaurant. You sit down, you look at the menu, and you decide you want to order the market price mystery fish.
Okay, making me hungry.
Right. So the waiter takes your order, but here's the catch. The price you pay isn't based on what the fisherman caught this morning. It's based on whatever the fisherman manages to pull out of the ocean tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah.
You hand the menu back, they start cooking, and you literally do not know the exact price of your meal when you place the order.
That is exactly how forward pricing works in a mutual fund. Under SEC rules, mutual fund shares must be bought and redeemed at the next computed NAV after the receipt of the order.
You
Never the
pay.
current one, never the previous one.
But why? Why can't I just buy at whatever the price is right now, like a normal stock?
To prevent arbitrage. In the early days of mutual funds, before these strict rules were in place, savvy traders would watch the stock market close at 4 over 0 p.m.
Okay.
If the market had a massive rally at the end of the day, they knew the fund's assets were now worth a lot more. So they would quickly buy into the fund using the morning's stale lower price, instantly locking in a risk-free profit at the expense of the long-term shareholders.
Because the price hadn't updated yet.
Exactly. Forward pricing eliminates that entirely. If you want in, you take the next price, no matter what it is.
Okay, let's bring in our second character to test this. Long-term Larry.
Larry.
Yeah, Larry is patient. He buys and holds. He's not trying to day trade. Larry logs into his brokerage account and places an order to buy an S&P 500 mutual fund at 3:55 p.m. Eastern Time. Listener, think about it. What price does Larry get? Take a beat. He gets that day's 4:00 p.m. NAV because the NAV is calculated at 4:00 p.m. and he got his order in 5 minutes before the cutoff.
You're right. The next calculation happened 5 minutes later, so he gets that price.
But what if Larry gets a phone call, gets distracted, and places his order at 4:05 p.m.? Now what?
Well, he missed the cutoff. The 4:00 p.m. calculation is now in the past. So Larry has to wait for the next computed NAV. He will not get his price until 4:00 p.m. the following business day.
So he is flying blind for 24 hours.
He is. It requires a lot of trust.
It really does. Now, we keep saying NAV,
Yeah.
net asset value. But as a retail investor, I rarely just pay the raw NAV, do I?
Not if you're using a broker. If you buy through a broker, there's usually a sales charge, often called a load. The actual final price an investor pays out of pocket is called the public offering price, or POP.
Okay, math time. This is where I always get tripped up. Let's say I want to calculate the POP. The NAV is $10, and the broker tells me there's a 5% sales charge. So if I'm taking the exam, I just take 5% of the $10 NAV. That's 50 cents. I add it to the $10, and the POP is $10.50. Simple.
And if you do that on the Series 7, you will fail that question immediately.
Ouch.
Yeah, that is the ultimate mathematical trap of this entire section.
Whoa. Why is that wrong? It seems so intuitive.
Because the sales charge percentage is never, ever calculated on the NAV. It is always calculated as a percentage of the public offering price itself.
Explain the logic of that. Why calculate the fee based on the final price rather than the base price of the asset? That feels backwards.
Think about it from the broker's perspective. When Larry hands over a check for $10,000 to invest, that $10,000 is the public offering price. That is the total pile of money on the table. The broker takes their 5% cut out of that total pile of money first, and whatever is left over is what actually buys the NAV shares. The fee is a percentage of the total dollars invested, not a markup on the wholesale price.
Oh, okay. So how do I actually calculate the POP if I only know the NAV and the fee percentage? Like if I don't know the final check amount?
You use division, not multiplication.
Yeah.
The formula is POP equals the NAV divided by, in parentheses, 1 minus the sales charge percentage.
Okay, let's use real numbers to anchor this. Let's say the NAV is $9.40. Sales charge is 6%.
Okay, so it's 9.4 divided by 1 minus 0.06.
Which is 0.94.
Right. So 9.40 divided by 0.94.
Let me do that in my head. 9.40 divided by 0.94, that equals exactly $10.
Correct. The POP is $10. The sales charge is the 60-cent difference. And if you check the math backwards, 60 cents is exactly 6% of the $10 total POP.
But if I had incorrectly taken 6% of the 9.4 NAV, I would have gotten, 56 cents? I would have added up to 9.96, and I would have chosen the wrong multiple choice answer.
Exactly. And the test writers will always put 9.96 as option A to trick you.
So sneaky.
They know people default to multiplication. Always divide by the complement of the sales charge.
That is devious. Okay, so we know there are sales charges, but when you pay them and how you pay them depends entirely on what letter is stamped on your shares. Let's talk about the alphabet soup. Share classes A, B, and C.
And to be clear, right off the bat, the share class does not change what the fund invests in. A Class A share and a Class B share own the exact same slice of the exact same crock pot.
Right.
The only difference is the fee structure.
Let's bring the cast of characters back. We have long-term Larry, bargain-hunting Betty, and frantic Fiona. Let's start with long-term Larry. Larry is dropping $100,000, and he is going to hold this fund for 20 years until retirement. He buys Class A shares. Why?
Because Class A shares have a front-end load. You pay a large sales charge up front, right out of your initial check.
Which sounds bad initially.
It does. But in exchange, Class A shares offer volume discounts, called breakpoints. Because Larry is investing a large sum, his upfront fee percentage drops significantly.
Nice.
Furthermore, Class A shares have the lowest ongoing annual operating fees. For a big, long-term hold, eating the upfront cost to secure cheap long-term maintenance is the mathematically correct move.
Okay, now meet bargain-hunting Betty. Betty hates upfront fees. The idea of writing a $10,000 check and only seeing $9,500 hit her account makes her furious.
I get it.
She wants 100% of her money working in the market on day one, so she buys Class B shares.
And she gets her wish. Class B shares have zero front-end load. Every dollar she gives the broker goes directly into the NAV. However, she faces a back-end load, officially called a contingent deferred sales charge, or CDSE.
Contingent, meaning it depends on something.
It depends entirely on how long she holds the shares. It is a declining penalty.
How does that look?
Well, if she panics and sells in year one, the fund might hit her with a massive 5% exit penalty. But if she holds to year two, it drops to 4%. Year three, 3%. And typically by year six or seven, that exit penalty drops all the way to zero.
So Betty just has to be patient.
Huh.
But there is a magic trick with Class B shares, right? Something happens when that penalty hits zero.
Yes. Once the CDSE expires, Class B shares automatically convert into Class A shares.
Poof. But why does Betty care if her shares change a letter? Like, who cares?
Because while she was holding those Class B shares, she was paying significantly higher ongoing annual fees to compensate the broker for not charging her up front.
Ah.
When the shares convert to Class A, her ongoing annual fee drag drops like a rock. She gets the best of both worlds, provided she waited out the penalty period.
No, listener, exam trap alert. When Betty's shares magically transform from Class B to Class A, the IRS is usually hovering around waiting to tax any transaction. Does this conversion trigger a capital gains tax?
It does not. The IRS views this purely as a structural administrative change within the exact same asset. It is a non-taxable event.
Nice. Finally, we have frantic Fiona. Fiona has commitment issues. She changes her mind constantly. She doesn't want to pay a front-end fee, but she also refuses to be locked into a fund for 7 years with a heavy back-end penalty. So she buys Class C shares.
Right. Class C shares are the level load shares. They generally have no front-end fee, and their back-end CDSC is usually just 1%, and it completely disappears after just one single year.
That sounds incredible. No upfront fee, and I can leave without penalty after 12 months. Why wouldn't everyone just buy Class C?
Because the catch is brutal over the long term. Class C shares have the highest ongoing annual fees of any share class, and unlike Class B, they never convert to Class A.
Oh, never.
Never. If long-term Larry bought Class C shares and held them for 20 years, that high annual fee would act like a parasite, quietly eating massive chunks of his compound interest. Class C is only suitable for a short-term time horizon.
Which makes it perfect for frantic Fiona and disastrous for long-term Larry. Suitability is everything here. Now, you keep mentioning these ongoing annual fees, the parasite fees. I'm talking about 12B1 fees. I'm going to drop my voice to a whisper here. Listener, let me tell you a secret the industry doesn't like to advertise. No load doesn't mean free.
And that is a secret the exam fully expects you to know. A no-load fund simply means there is no front-end sales charge and no back-end CDSC. It does not mean the fund operates for charity. They can still charge you a 12B1 fee every single year.
Explain exactly what a 12B1 fee is paying for, because it feels like a hidden tax.
It essentially is. A 12B1 fee is deducted directly from the fund's total assets each year to pay for distribution, marketing, and shareholder services.
Wait, marketing. So if I own the fund, they are taking my money, lowering my return to pay for television commercials to convince other people to buy the fund.
That is exactly what is happening. You are subsidizing their asset gathering.
That's wild.
Now, there are strict limits. For a fund to legally market itself as a no-load fund, its 12B1 fee cannot exceed 0.25% per year. If they charge even 0.26%, they are legally barred from using the term no-load.
But they can charge more than 0.25 if they drop the no-load title, right? What is the maximum parasite level?
The absolute maximum 12B1 fee MANORI allows is 1.00% annually. That is capped at 0.75% for marketing and distribution, plus a maximum 0.25% for shareholder services.
And these 12B1 fees are bundled into what we call the fund's expense ratio, correct?
Yes. The expense ratio is the grand total of the fund's operational drag. It includes the management fee paid to the investment advisor, the 12B1 fees, the legal fees, the accounting fees.
Okay, trap time. Does the expense ratio include the sales loads we talked about earlier? Like, does it include Larry's front-end charge or Betty's back-end penalty?
Absolutely not. And that is a guaranteed exam question. The expense ratio only captures ongoing internal operating expenses. Sales loads are external, one-time transactional fees paid to brokers. They are completely separate. Oh, and brokerage commissions that the fund pays when it trades stocks inside the portfolio. Also excluded from the expense ratio.
Okay, let's pivot to the human element of this. How these things are actually sold by brokers. You mentioned that long-term Larry bought Class A shares because he wanted volume discounts, known as breakpoints. How exactly does a breakpoint schedule work in reality?
It's a tiered discount system. The more cash you put on the table, the lower your sales charge percentage. For example, the prospectus might state that investments under $25,000 carry a 5% load. But if you hit exactly $25,000, the load drops to 4%.
So let's say Larry is sitting in a broker's office. He has a checkbook in his hand. He says, I want to invest $24,000 today. The broker knows that if Larry invests $24,000, the fee is 5%, which means a bigger commission for the broker. But if Larry just found another $1,000, the fee drops to 4%. What is the broker legally required to do?
The broker is legally obligated to stop the transaction and fully disclose the breakpoint. They have to tell Larry, hey, you are only $1,000 away from a massive discount.
And what if they don't? What if they just take the $24,000, say thanks, and pocket the higher commission?
That is a severe FANRA violation known as breakpoint selling.
Breakpoint selling.
Yeah. Soliciting or even just processing a purchase just below a breakpoint threshold without disclosure is considered highly unethical and punitive to the client.
Okay, but let's be real. What if Larry says, I appreciate you telling me, but I literally only have $24,000 in my bank account right now. I don't have the extra grand, but I am getting a guaranteed year-end bonus in a few months, and I'll invest more then. Is Larry just screwed out of the discount today?
Not if he utilizes a letter of intent or LOI.
A letter of intent. It sounds like he's signing a treaty.
It's a formal written statement where Larry commits to investing a specified total dollar amount over the next 13 months.
13 months? That's a very specific number for the exam.
Highly testable. 13 months. And here is the benefit. The moment Larry signs the LOI today, the fund applies the lower 4% breakpoint discount to today's $24,000 purchase based purely on his promise to reach $25,000 within 13 months. Wow, okay. Furthermore, an LOI can even be backdated up to 90 days to include recent purchases in the total.
But wait, Larry works in tech. What if his company does massive layoffs next month? He loses his job, he doesn't get the bonus, and 13 months pass, and he never invests that final $1,000. Does FINAR send repo men to his house to collect the discounted fee?
No, because an LOI is fundamentally non-binding. Larry is not legally compelled to invest the remaining funds. He can just walk away.
So how does the mutual fund protect itself from people just, you know, lying to get cheap fees today?
Escrow. When Larry signs the LOI and gets his discounted shares today, the fund quietly takes a portion of those shares, usually representing the difference in the sales charge, and locks them in an escrow account. Right. If 13 months pass and Larry fails to meet his commitment, the fund simply liquidates those escrowed shares, keeps the cash to cover the higher sales charge he should have paid, and gives Larry whatever's left.
Brilliant. They hold their own collateral. Okay, so a letter of intent looks forward 13 months into the future, but what if Larry has just been slowly drip investing $500 a month for a decade, and his account balance naturally crosses a breakpoint threshold?
Then he benefits from rights of accumulation, or ROA. This allows investors to qualify for breakpoint discounts on new purchases by adding the value of their existing holdings in that fund family.
And here is a critical distinction for the exam. When they calculate his existing holdings, are they looking at the total amount of money he originally put in or what the account is worth today?
Current market value, always. If Larry slowly invested $15,000 over 10 years, but due to a massive bull market, that account is now worth $50,000, his ROA credit is $50,000.
That's awesome.
Yeah, any new money he invests today gets a breakpoint discount assigned to the $50,000 tier.
So ROA looks backward at the current value of your history, while LOI looks forward 13 months at your promised future.
Exactly. And remember, ROA only works within the same fund family. You cannot aggregate your Vanguard balances to demand a discount from Fidelity.
Makes sense. Now, while we are talking about Larry slowly investing $500 a month, let's talk about dollar cost averaging, or DCA. This is a massive test concept. DCA is simply the act of investing fixed dollar amounts at regular set intervals, regardless of what the market is doing.
Yes. $500 on the first of every month, whether the market is hitting all-time highs or crashing into a recession.
And mathematically, this creates a fascinating outcome because of what a fixed dollar amount forces you to do.
Right. When the stock market is roaring and prices are high, your fixed $500 naturally buys fewer shares. But when the market crashes and everyone else is panicking and selling, your automated $500 swoops in and scoops up a massive number of cheap shares.
Right.
It forces you to buy low, removing human emotion entirely.
And over time, this creates a mathematical phenomenon where your average cost per share is lower than your average price per share. Listener, exam trap alert. You need to know the difference between those two terms. Let's break it down.
Okay, so average price per share is incredibly simple. It's just the sum of the share prices on the days you bought, divided by the number of times you bought. If you bought in January at $10, February $20, and March at $30, the average price is $20. Simple division.
But my average cost per share is different.
Vastly different, and always lower in a fluctuating market.
Hmm.
Average cost is calculated by taking the total dollars you invested and dividing it by the total number of shares you actually accumulated.
Okay.
Because your $500 bought way, way more shares when the price was $10 than when it was $30. Your portfolio is heavily weighted with cheap shares. The math tilts in your favor.
Okay, so if it mathematically lowers my average cost, that means dollar cost averaging guarantees I will make a profit, right?
And that is exactly what the exam wants you to assume. No, it never, ever guarantees a profit.
It doesn't.
Not at all. It does not protect against a loss in a steadily declining market. If the stock market just goes down, down, down forever, you are still going to lose your money. DCA just means you are losing it slightly more efficiently than someone who bought all at once at the top.
A very depressing, mathematically efficient loss. Okay, so our cast of characters have bought their funds, navigated the fees, and held on for years. Now they want their money back. Let's talk redemption.
The golden rule of open-end redemptions. When an investor requests their money, the mutual fund must send the payment within 7 calendar days.
Wait, calendar days, not business days. So if I submit a sell order on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the fund can't hide behind the 4-day holiday weekend and say, sorry, banks were closed, we'll get to it next week.
It absolutely cannot. The 1940 Act mandates 7 calendar days, period. Weekends and holidays count against their clock. It forces funds to maintain high liquidity.
Love that for the retail investor. Now, what about bargain hunting Betty? Remember, she bought Class B shares to avoid upfront fees, but she has that back-end CDSC penalty hovering over her. Let's say she panics and wants to sell in year two while the penalty is still active. How do they calculate the hit?
Right.
If she originally bought the shares at $20, but there was a massive bull market and the NAV is now $30, are they penalizing her on the $20 or the $30?
They calculate the penalty on the lesser of her original purchase price, or the current NAV.
The lesser of. So they only hit the $20 base.
Correct. The SEC rules protect the investor from paying a sales charge on the capital appreciation they earned. They only penalize the principal she put in.
That's surprisingly generous of Wall Street. Now, what order do they sell her shares in? If she's been buying shares every month for years and reinvesting her dividends, she has a massive pile of shares, all with different CDSC expiration clocks.
The industry uses a very specific order to minimize the pain. First, the fund redeems any shares that are not subject to a charge at all.
Like what?
For instance, any shares acquired through reinvested dividends are almost always exempt from CDSC. The fund burns those off first.
Okay, the freebies go first, and then?
Then they use FIFO, yeah. First in, first out. They sell the oldest charged shares first, because those are the shares closest to having their penalty expire or have already aged out of the penalty window entirely.
Okay, let's talk about the scariest topic for any investor, taxes. Specifically, subchapter M of the IRS code, often called the pipeline or conduit theory.
This is huge.
Let me set the stage. A massive mutual fund makes $1 billion in profit this year from trading stocks. Usually, a corporation that makes $1 billion has to pay corporate income tax. So why doesn't a mutual fund pay massive corporate taxes before distributing the leftovers to investors?
Imagine if they did. If a mutual fund made $1 billion and paid a 21% corporate tax rate, that's $210 million instantly vaporized. Then they distribute the remaining $790 million to retail investors like Larry and Betty. Larry and Betty then have to declare the money on their personal tax returns and pay another 20% in personal capital gains. By the time the money actually hits Larry's checking account, almost half the return has been incinerated by double taxation.
Which would make mutual funds the worst investment vehicle on the planet. Nobody would buy them.
Exactly. Retail investing would collapse.
Yep.
So the IRS created subchapter M, which allows a mutual fund to act simply as a conduit, a pipeline. The money flows straight through the fund, untouched by corporate taxes, directly to the investors, who then pay the tax just once at their personal rate.
But the IRS doesn't just hand out tax-exempt status for free. What hoops does the fund have to jump through to use this pipeline?
Two massive tests. First, to even qualify as a regulated investment company, or RIC, at least 90% of the fund's gross income must be true investment income. Dividends, interest, capital gains. They cannot generate income from operating a side business.
Right, so Fiona's fund can't buy a struggling chain of car washes and run them for extra cash.
Correct. But the second test is the critical one for maintaining the tax-free pipeline. The fund must distribute at least 90% of its net investment income to its shareholders every single year.
They have to physically push 90% of the cash out the door.
They do. And if a fund only distributes 89%.
What happens?
The IRS revokes their conduit status, the pipeline slams shut, and the fund is heavily taxed as a regular C corporation on 100% of its income. Is a catastrophic failure for the portfolio manager.
Okay, so the money successfully makes it through the pipeline to long-term Larry. How is it taxed on his end? Let's say the fund distributes a long-term capital gain.
Here is a major, major exam trap. Listen closely.
Okay.
Long-term capital gain distributions from a mutual fund are taxed at favorable long-term capital gains rates for the investor, regardless of how long the investor has actually held the mutual fund shares.
Wait. Let's say Larry just opened his account. He has only owned Fiona's mutual fund for 2 weeks, but Fiona's fund just sold a huge block of Apple stock that the fund had been holding for 5 years, and she distributes that profit to Larry. Does Larry get the long-term tax rate even though he's only been here 14 days?
Yes, he does. Because under conduit theory, the tax status is determined by how long the fund held the underlying asset, not how long Larry held the fund. The tax character flows through the pipeline unchanged.
That is incredibly counterintuitive. I guarantee people get that wrong on the test.
They do all the time.
Okay, one more tax trap. What about reinvested dividends? Let's say Larry checks a box on his account that says automatically reinvest all my dividends to buy more shares. He never touches the cash. It never goes into his checking account. Since he didn't get the cash, he doesn't owe taxes this year, right?
Right. Wrong. That is phantom income, and it is fully taxable in the year it is distributed. The IRS treats reinvestment exactly as if the fund handed Larry a physical check, and Larry immediately turned around and handed it back to buy more shares. You owe the taxes on reinvested dividends immediately, out of pocket.
Ouch. Okay, so all of this, the forward pricing at 4.0 p.m., the 7-day calendar redemption, the pipeline rules, it all feels a little old school. Very 1990s. Let's fast forward to today.
Let's do it.
What if Frantic Fiona doesn't want to manage a mutual fund? What if she just wants to day trade a fund like she day trades volatile tech stocks? She wants to buy a fund at 10 a.m., short it at noon, and buy it on margin at 2 p.m. We already established the 1940 Act strictly forbids using margin on open-end mutual funds.
Right. Mutual funds are too clunky for Fiona.
All right.
For that kind of high-speed intraday flexibility, we must introduce the modern marvel of Wall Street, the exchange-traded fund, the ETF.
The heavyweight champion of modern investment.
ETFs are legally registered investment companies, just like mutual funds. They hold baskets of stocks, but they trade continuously intraday on the major stock exchanges. You can buy them on margin. You can short them. You can place limit orders and stop loss orders on them. They behave exactly like a single stock.
But wait, earlier you told me that closed-end funds trade on exchanges, and because of supply and demand, they almost always trade at massive discounts to their actual NAV. Why doesn't a massive S&P 500 ETF trade at a 10% discount? How does the ETF share price always stay perfectly glued to the actual value of the S&P 500?
Because of a brilliant structural mechanism. I like to call it the magic Lego exchange.
Yes. Walk me through the Legos.
The entire ETF ecosystem relies on specialized institutional heavyweight investors called authorized participants, or APs.
Okay, I am picturing the APs as master Lego builders sitting in a back room.
Perfect. Now, unlike a mutual fund, individual retail investors like Fiona cannot create or redeem shares directly with the ETF sponsor for cash. If Fiona wants to buy an ETF, she just buys it from another trader on the exchange. The only entities allowed to interact directly with the ETF's creator are the authorized participants.
So what do the master builders actually do?
They perform in-kind creation and redemption. Let's say an ETF is trading at a discount. Panic in the market drives the ETF share price down to $98, even though the actual stocks inside the ETF are mathematically worth $100.
The market is broken.
Right. So the AP steps in to exploit this. They buy up millions of these cheap $98 ETF shares on the open market. They take those shares to the ETF sponsor, and they swap them not for cash, but for the actual physical underlying stocks.
They hand over the fully assembled Lego castle. In an exchange, the fund gives them the individual Lego bricks.
Exactly. And because they bought the assembled castle for $98, but the individual bricks are worth $100, the AP instantly sells those individual bricks on the stock market for a massive, risk-free arbitrage profit.
And here's the magic part. By buying up millions of those cheap ETF shares to execute the trade, the AP absorbs all the excess supply on the market, which naturally drives the price of the ETF right back up to $100, perfectly matching the NAV again.
Exactly. The AP's greed acts as a self-correcting pricing mechanism, and the process works in exact reverse if the ETF ever trades at a premium. The APs assemble new Lego castles and flood the market with them to drive the price down.
That is genius. But why in kind? Why swap shares for actual stocks? Why doesn't the ETF just hand the AP cash?
Tax efficiency. This is the superpower of the ETF. Because the ETF sponsor is simply swapping a basket of stocks for shares, there is no actual cash sale occurring. And without a cash sale, the fund does not realize a capital gain.
Wait. So if long-term Larry is holding a mutual fund and 10,000 panicking investors demand their money back, the mutual fund has to sell stocks for cash to pay them, which triggers massive capital gains taxes for Larry, who didn't even do anything.
Correct. But if Larry is in an ETF and 10,000 people sell, the AP just swaps shares for stocks. No cash sale, no tax event for the fund. Larry is completely shielded from the tax consequences of other people's panic.
Okay, ETFs are amazing. But what about an ETN, exchange traded note? It's one letter different. I assume they're basically the same thing with a different legal wrapper.
That assumption will cost you dearly on the exam, and it could destroy your real life portfolio. An ETN is absolutely not an ETF.
Why? What is an ETN?
An ETN is not a fund. It does not hold a basket of stocks. It is a senior unsecured debt obligation issued by a major bank. It is quite literally just an IOU.
So it holds nothing?
Nothing. It is a promise. The bank promises to pay you the return of a specific index, minus their fees, when the note matures.
So if I buy an S&P 500 ETN and the S&P goes up 20%, the bank just looks at the index, does the math, and writes me a check for the 20% gain.
Yes. But here is the catastrophic risk that separates it from an ETF. Issuer credit risk. Because an ETN is just an unsecured promise, if the bank that issued it goes bankrupt, you lose your money.
Wow.
In 2008, people held ETNs issued by Lehman Brothers. The underlying indexes were fine, but when Lehman collapsed, those ETNs became worthless pieces of paper. With an ETF, you own the underlying assets. With an ETN, you own a bank's promise.
That is terrifying. Okay, ETF holds actual assets, market risk only. ETN holds zero assets, carries massive credit risk if the bank dies. Let's do one more ETF variation, leveraged ETFs. Let's say Fiona buys a 2x leveraged S&P 500 ETF. She plans to hold it for a whole year. If the S&P goes up 10% for the year, Fiona's 2x ETF goes up 20% for the year. Easy math.
An easy way to lose all your money. Leveraged and inverse ETFs are strictly designed for short-term, intraday trading only, never for a buy-and-hold strategy.
2 times 10 is 20?
Because they aim to deliver a multiple of the daily return, not the cumulative annual return.
Yeah.
Because they reset their leverage every single night, you suffer from something called compounding drag in a volatile market. Let's walk through the math slowly.
Okay, let's do it. Day one.
Let's say the base index is at 100. It's a bad day. The index drops 10%. It closes at 90.
Okay.
Day two. The market bounces back. The index rises 10%. What is 10% of 90?
9.
So 90 plus 9 is 99. Over 2 days of volatility, the base index started at 100 and ended at 99. It is down exactly 1% overall.
Simple enough. Now let's track Fiona's 2x ETF over those same 2 days.
The ETF also starts at 100. Day one, the index drops 10%. Yeah. So the 2x ETF must drop 20%. It closes at 80.
Okay, she's down to 80 bucks.
Day two, the index rises 10%. The 2x ETF must rise 20%. What is a 20% gain on her $80?
10% is 8, so 20% is 16. 80 plus 16 is 96.
Look at the final numbers. The plain index is down 1%, but Fiona's 2x ETF is down 4%.
Whoa, she didn't lose double, she lost quadruple.
That is compounding drag. In a choppy, volatile market, the daily reset absolutely mathematically destroys the long-term value of the ETF. They are day trading tools, totally unsuitable for long-term Larry.
Okay, we've covered massive ground. We have APs swapping Legos, banks writing IOUs, compounding drag destroying portfolios. With billions of dollars flying around, who keeps these mutual fund managers from just going rogue? Let's open up the rule book, governance and restrictions under the 1940 Act.
The foundational rule of 1940 Act governance is that a fund cannot pull a bait and switch on its investors. If you market yourself as a conservative municipal bond fund, the manager cannot wake up on a Tuesday and decide to put 50% of the assets into speculative crypto startups just because they think it will pop.
So they cannot change their fundamental investment policies.
Not without asking permission. A fund cannot change its stated investment objective, its borrowing policy, its status as an open-end or closed-end fund, or its status as diversified or non-diversified without approval from a majority of the outstanding voting securities.
Wait, the board of directors can't just vote on it in a closed-door meeting.
No. The board alone is powerless to change those fundamental policies. It requires a direct vote from the shareholders.
Now, in the real world, majority usually just means 51%. But the SEC loves to make things complicated. Under the 1940 Act, majority has a very bizarre two-pronged definition, doesn't it?
It does, and you have to memorize it. The Act defines a majority vote as the lesser of two options. Option A, 67% of the shares present at a meeting, assuming at least 50% of all outstanding shares are represented.
Okay.
Or option B, more than 50% of all outstanding shares. Whichever of those two mathematical thresholds is lower is the one that legally constitutes a majority.
Okay, so shareholders hold the ultimate power for big structural changes. What about the board of directors itself? Is it just the portfolio manager and his five best golfing buddies rubber stamping everything?
The 1940 Act strictly mandates independence to prevent that exact scenario. At the baseline, at least 40% of the board of directors must be non-interested persons, meaning they have no direct affiliation with the fund's investment advisor.
40%. But didn't you note in your prep that some specific SEC rules require an even higher threshold?
Yes. While 40% is the general baseline for the exam, if a fund wants to rely on certain SEC exemptive rules, for example, if they want to charge those 12B1 marketing fees we talked about, they must cross a higher bar and have a strict majority over 50% of independent directors. But if the exam asks for the general 1940 Act baseline, 40% is your number.
Okay, let's talk about the 1940 Act naughty list. Let's say frantic Fiona is running her open-end mutual fund and she is feeling aggressive. She wants to juice her returns. What is she strictly forbidden from doing?
The fund itself cannot purchase securities on margin. It cannot participate in a joint trading account with another entity, and it cannot sell securities short.
But wait, didn't we say earlier that Fiona, acting as a retail trader, could buy an ETF on margin and short an ETF?
Yes, and this is a critical distinction that trips people up. Fiona, the retail shareholder, can short ETF shares on the secondary market all day long. But the ETF fund itself, the manager running the multi-billion-dollar portfolio inside the fund, is bound by the 1940 Act. the manager cannot short the underlying stocks. The naughty list applies to the internal operations of the fund, not to the secondary market traders.
Got it. Okay, one last rule. I'm flashing a giant mental red light right now. Wee-woo-wee-woo, alert! Alert! Why am I sounding the alarm?
Because we need to talk about the FDIC violation. It is a catastrophic, career-ending violation for a broker to ever claim or even imply that a mutual fund is guaranteed, sponsored, or approved by the U.S. government, or that it is insured by the FDIC.
What if the mutual fund literally invests with 100% of its assets in U.S. Treasury bonds? Those are backed by the government.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The underlying bonds might be backed, but the mutual fund wrapper is not. If the fund's manager embezzles the money, the government isn't bailing you out. Furthermore, if a mutual fund is being sold inside a physical bank lobby, the representative must go out of their way to prominently disclose that the investment is absolutely not FDIC insured and can lose value. Never say FDIC.
All right, we are in the home stretch. You are sitting in the testing center. The clock is ticking. Let's do a rapid fire brain dump. The top five absolute must know facts from everything we just covered. Go.
Number one, forward pricing. When you place a mutual fund order, you get the NXT computed NAV. You are always buying blind.
Number two, sales charges. The broker's cut is always calculated as a percentage of the public offering price, the total pile of money. Never, ever calculated off the NAV.
Number three, pricing differences. Closed-end funds trade on an exchange based on supply and demand, and they usually trade at a discount to their NAV. Open-end funds continuously issue shares priced exactly at NAV.
Number four, sales practices. Breakpoint selling, which is hiding a discount from a client just to pocket a higher commission, is a severe violation. Letters of intent look forward 13 months. Rights of accumulation look backward at your current market value.
And number five, subchapter M conduit theory. A fund must distribute at least 90% of its net investment income to shareholders to maintain the pipeline and avoid double taxation.
Boom! Nailed it. Now, we've covered a massive amount of ground today, from the prehistoric T-Rex of face amount certificates to the Lego arbitrage magic of ETFs. Before we wrap up, give me something provocative. Give me a thought to chew on that pushes past what's just on the Series 7. Where is all this going?
Well, we touched briefly on interval funds today. They are technically categorized as closed-end funds, but they aren't listed on an exchange. Instead, they offer periodic buybacks. The fund promises to buy back, say, 5 to 25% of its shares every quarter.
Right. They sit in this weird hybrid space.
Here's the thought to chew on. Historically, retail investors have only had access to highly liquid, publicly traded stocks and bonds. But today, investors desperately crave the massive returns found in highly illiquid assets, private credit, direct commercial real estate, venture capital.
But you can't put illiquid stuff in an open-end mutual fund.
Exactly. You can't put a shopping mall in mutual fund because if investors demand their money back on Tuesday, you can't sell a shopping mall on Wednesday to pay them. But an interval fund, it caps redemptions. It legally locks the money up just enough to allow the manager to invest heavily in the private markets.
That was the question.
The massive question the industry is wrestling with right now is this. As the private markets continue to outpace the public markets, could the interval fund eventually replace the traditional open-end mutual fund model entirely for long-term retirement accounts? If you are 30 years away from retirement, why demand daily liquidity? Why not lock your money up for higher returns?
That is fascinating. Voluntarily surrendering daily liquidity in exchange for access to the private markets. It really shows how this entire ecosystem is constantly mutating to find new edges, which brings us right back to where we started. Buying a fund is not a clean binary click of a button. It is a living, breathing, murky ecosystem full of APs, leverage rules, 12b1 parasites, and conduit taxes. But hopefully after today, the water is a lot less muddy for you.
You have the diagnostic tools now. You know where the traps are hidden. You just had to apply them.
That's it for this deep dive. Go crush those practice exams.